Hello, welcome to the Bearded Tits podcast, hosted by me, Jack Perks. Professionally, I'm a wildlife cameraman, but I dabble in podcasting, and each Tuesday, we release an episode as I have a chat with scientists, artists, filmmakers, and passionate people all about nature in a light-hearted and certainly not serious way. Hello and welcome to the Bearded Tits podcast. I'm your host, Jack Perks. Now in today's episode, I've got Ben Rosen from the National Museum of Wales, and he is the senior curator for terrestrial mollusks, e.g. slugs and snails. So we're going to be covering all things slugs in today's podcast, the good, the bad and the ugly. I've got my own personal feelings about slugs, which I'll talk a little bit before we start. But before we do that, I want to mention buymeacoffee.com. Now, if you want to support this podcast, maybe you've listened to a few episodes, maybe this is the first episode that you've listened to, and you're liking the cut of my jib, then you can... Fucking hell, that was awful. If you want to donate some money, you can. It's independent, so I've got no sponsorship. The only way that I can keep this going is if you, the listener, donate something. It can be as little as a fiver, basically the price of a coffee or a pint of beer. And it just keeps me going. It means that I can stay independent, and I can say and do things that would maybe constrict other podcasts. So if you can do that, it's much appreciated. The other thing that happens is you can leave a message. So I'm going to read out some of the messages and donations that people have done. I got quite a few this week, so thank you very much for everyone who's donated. We've got Wolf Greenman, who's bought me a coffee. Thanks very much, Wolf. Great name. Julia bought me two coffees, and she's written, huge fan of this podcast. Cheers, Julia. That's lovely. Thanks for sending me two coffees. John Bellis bought me a coffee. Cheers, John. Michelle Walker, she bought me three coffees. Good for you, Michelle. You're a legend. Really happy to discover this podcast, Jack. I'm glad you discovered it too, because now you've just paid for a bottle of Jack Daniels or something for me. Or scotch, really. I don't know. I wouldn't drink Jack Daniels now. And then @West4 bought me two coffees. I don't think that's their real name. But thanks so much. And they've put interesting and informative podcasts. So for everyone who's donated, massively appreciated. I can't thank you enough. It just means that I can keep the ball rolling with this a little bit longer. Now, this is the penultimate episode of this season. I do this in 20 episode blocks, so it's been a wild ride. I've kind of gone through highs and lows on what to do with the podcast. I'm going to talk about that in the final episode next week, about the future of the podcast and what's going to happen with it. But yeah, thank you so much for the support that people have given me. I've had lots of wonderfully kind messages from people saying they really enjoy it, and obviously more people have started donating as well, which is meaning that I'm able to go off and do podcast further afield, which I'm really enjoying as well. So yeah, thanks a lot for that. Anyway, let's get back into today's episode. So before we get chatting to Ben, and it's a really informative podcast that I do with Ben, I just want to kind of give you some background with me and slugs. Many of you will know, if you're regular listeners, that I am an avid wildlife gardener. And I use the term wildlife gardener because I think just plain gardeners will unanimously hate slugs. Whereas, because I'm trying to encourage wildlife to my garden, I can't be that surprised when I get slugs. And they've got their part in the ecosystem, and I appreciate that. However, 2023 has been one of the wettest summers on record. So it's just been an absolute playground for slugs in my garden, because it's just been warm and wet. So they've just been going absolutely fucking nuts in the garden. Which has meant that when I've tried to plant new plants in my meadow, because what I basically do, I've got a wildflower patch in my back garden, and each year I'll try new flowers. I like to spice it up a little bit. I'm just a crazy guy like that. So I might put some red campion in, or some cornflower, or just kind of change the colour palette. I treat wildflowers like a painting, without getting too deep, and I like to change the colours each year. And every time I've put young, new plants in, the slugs have fucking decimated them, which has been really, really frustrating. So we're going to talk to Ben a little bit about what you can do. Is it a case of, have you got to live with it? Or are there things that you can actually do to get rid of slugs? Is it all slugs? Which slugs are the problem? And ultimately, can I learn to live with slugs? Here's our chat. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Thank you, Jack.
How are we doing? We all good?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, lovely sunny day here in South Wales. Not raining, so perhaps there won't be any slugs around.
I know. Well, this winter's been just dreadful. Probably good for slugs, I imagine. I don't know. Like, kind of mild and wet. That's good, isn't it?
The mild and wet is normally good, but we've had an awful lot of heavy rain, at least in this part of the country, and that's forced a lot of slugs out of the ground. So there's been quite a lot of record of the subterranean species,
Oh, really?
a tribute to the saturated soil and everything.
Well, before we start, do you want to just say who you are and what you do?
So my name is Ben Rosen. I'm a curator at Amgueddfa Cymru, the National Museum of Wales, in the zoology department, the natural sciences department. I'm a specialist in non-marine mollusks, so that's slugs and snails, which I'm going to try and mention at every opportunity, probably. Slugs and snails, and also other non-marine mollusks. I'm also in the Conchological Society of Great Britain and Ireland, established 1876, which is a membership organization which does everything to do with mollusks, and we have talks and field events and all kinds of things. So that's a plug for a society I'm involved with as well.
Is that because here's me being naive? Because I know there's a society for everything. There's a moth society, there's a fungus society. So it shouldn't be a surprise to me that there's a slug and snail society. Is that well attended? Like, are many people in it?
It's well, small but perfectly formed, I suppose you could call it. No.
I've heard
It's
that before. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
never been huge, but no, we're really sincere about all the different aspects of mollusks, and that includes like shell collecting as well,
Yeah.
which is often a great way into nature, and it crosses different biomes as well because all the marine stuff. Mollusks include things like the cephalopods. You've done an episode on giant squid, haven't you? And
Yes,
they're
with John
A
Ablett,
different
yeah.
class of animal altogether, but they are related to gastropods, slugs and snails. So there are actually a few malacological societies, but the Conchological Society is the main one to do with amateur recording and field work and the British and Irish species.
Wow, because I'm hoping what you can do today is try and convince myself and listeners to give slugs and snails a little bit more love, because I've been having somewhat of a, I think the only fair way to describe it is a war with them in my garden. And it sort of started off me getting mad, then even madder, then less mad. And now I've just sort of, they've worn me down to a point where I'm like, we've got to find a peaceful resolution between me and the slugs. So that's the point that I'm at. But before we go into kind of the gardening and stuff with them, I want to kind of try and infuse people about slugs. So how many species do we have in Britain?
Well, I hate to start with well,
Yeah, depends who you
but
ask, is it?
and until about 10 years ago, we thought there were about 35. It now looks like there are about 45.
Oh, okay.
If you include the semi-slugs, which I'm sure I'll come back to later. Yeah, it's about 45 species, so quite a lot. And in Europe, we're probably leading the field because this western fringe where things are mild and soggy is particularly good for them.
All right, so we're like the slug capital of Europe, then, are we?
We could, if there were a European slug capital competition every year, then we could certainly enter, yeah.
Okay, it'd be nice to win something, wouldn't it? Am I right in thinking that we also have an endemic slug?
I'm not sure about that. Probably
No,
not endemic, but
okay.
we do have species that have yet to be found anywhere else, which is a slightly different situation. So a bit more work has been done on them in the British fauna, but we don't re and we suspect they're introduced from elsewhere in Europe, but we can't prove that, and we don't really know where to look to
Right,
find them.
okay.
So st still a fascinating mystery, really.
Because I suppose because plants are so freely moved around, aren't they? It's not going to take much for a slug or slug eggs to be in a plant pot, is it? And then here we go.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the main way, I think. And of course, one thing about slugs and snails, a lot of the terrestrial species are hermaphrodites, and they are capable, at least in extreme deprivation, they can fertilize themselves and give rise to a whole population. So you only need, that means you either need one egg or one individual, and you can found a whole new garden's worth of slugs.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you this actually. You've kind of mentioned it there, but have you ever seen where slugs? I don't know the scientific terms, so you'll have to correct me, but I've seen it on nature documentaries where these slugs kind of create a load of mucus and twirl around each other. I'm probably not explaining it very well.
No, I know what you mean. That's
Okay.
one of their greatest hits, I think. So, I said they're simultaneous hermaphrodites, as are many of the garden and familiar snails that we have in Britain. So they're both male and female at the same time, which means that population is a reciprocal job. So they're both being males and they're both being females at the same time. And in the perfect scenario, they would both donate sperm to one another, or so they call it, exchange in sperm. But that's not always the case. And, you know, if you think about the evolutionary sort of game theory of it, then there are situations where the female interests of one partner or the male interests of one partner would overcome the other. And it could be in their evolutionary interest to donate sperm without accepting it from the other partner. So you're quite a complicated and amazing arms race going on in this race to control the outcome of copulation, which goes on beyond copulation itself, as it does in many animals, because they can store sperm and then the female side can choose whether or not to use a particular partner's sperm to fertilize a portion of their eggs. And snails do this. In snails, you might have heard of love darts, which is something that some British snails produce.
Yes, I have, yeah.
And that acts as a kind of paternity guard. So if a snail successfully darts its opponent, then it's going to fertilize a great proportion of the eggs. There are some slugs that do that, but not among the British species. Instead, some of them have taken this conflict to real extremes, and they've developed these very elaborate genitalia, which are extruded from the body. They're normally packed away neatly inside. They're pushed out by hydrostatic pressure. And in those species that hang upside down to mate with one another, the genitalia is so big that I think that's the only way to actually get them out of the body and get them to interact outside. So a bit like the tentacles of an octopus or a squid, which are also mollusks, these organs actually have their own complicated movements, and they can interact kind of apparently without the rest of the body moving. And it's quite a hypnotic spectacle if you've ever seen it firsthand.
No, I had a friend of mine who works in wildlife TV, and he lives in Bristol, and he said literally they were hanging off his windowsill. He just saw it kind of, he was sat watching telly, then he just glanced at his window and he saw these slugs doing it. He stopped the telly and watched that and instead, because yeah, it is a very strange, and if you've never seen it before, I'd definitely say kind of Google it. Hopefully nothing too dodgy will come up if you type in slug sex.
Just make sure you've got slugs in there. And you two will become entranced, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're definitely right. I remember hearing potentially that the snail's love dart is the origin of Cupid's arrow, but I don't know if that's complete bollocks or not. But I remember someone telling me that.
Well, I guess you could say that, but it's a bit like a dugong is the inspiration for a mermaid, and you know.
Yeah,
I can imagine a mermaid without having seen a dugong first, you know. So.
You'd have to have been at sea for a long time, wouldn't you?
You have to have very limited imagination.
Yeah.
Not occur to you until you'd seen one of them.
It would be a while, wouldn't it? This might be a basic question, but like, I mean, what is the difference between a slug and a snail? Is it as simple as one's got a shell and one hasn't, or is it a little bit more kind of complicated than that?
Well, so when I'm doing stuff with a museum, meeting the public, or out with a conch sock or whatever, that this comes up all the time. And essentially, slugs are a kind of special case of snails. You could call them super snails because they've arisen from snail ancestors, and their bodies have changed to allow them to become something better in an evolutionary sense. So they've got a niche. And obviously that niche is quite common here in the UK, given the climate and the kind of country that it is. And so there are plenty of niches for those slugs to exist. And we know this is advantageous to many groups of land snails, because it's happened at least 10 times, possibly as many as 20 independent times throughout their evolution. And the number of cases we've detected have gone up since people have used molecular methods to better refine the kind of tree of the family tree of terrestrial snails. And we know that in many cases they turn into slugs. And you can kind of see it with your own eyes if you look at the things we call semi-slugs. So there are a lot of those around. Some of them are quite common in Britain. You might find them in the woods or, strangely, in sand dunes on very wet days. And those are snails in which the shell is no longer quite big enough to contain the animal. So the body of the animal, the soft body, is the real creature, and the shell is just one part of it. If that grows to a certain extent, then it can no longer fit into the shell, so it can't use the shell as a refuge. And shell tends to become vestigial then. So it gets broader and flatter. And if you imagine like an abalone shell, which is like a spiral shell with very few whorls, it begins to look like that. And eventually it just becomes flat and ear-shaped or like a fingernail, or it disappears altogether. So you can see all these stages of evolution among all the various slugs and snails that are around today. And so you can use that to reconstruct how many times it's happened and where.
So would that mean that some slugs are more closely related to snails than they are other slugs? Because it's kind of
exactly
Really? Yeah. So that's amazing.
Exactly.
So is that convergent evolution or something else?
Yeah. It's
it
a really
is.
good example of that because the slopes look more or less superficially similar to one another, but they've all got different origins. And you can untangle it if you look carefully at some of the internal organs, which is something we often do to check a slug's identity. And the advantages of it, presumably, are quite strong because a lot of them do it. So one big thing, I think, is that it allows the snail, by losing the shell or at least reducing the shell, to fit into cracks and things better.
Yes,
which is a great refuge from predators, but particularly from dehydration, which is one of the leading causes of slug and snail mortality worldwide. So it allows them to paradoxically live in drier environments by losing their shell.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it also reduces their dependence on lime in the soil or in their diet. So that's, the alkalinity of the soil. Some snails are very restricted to calcium-rich environments. Like chalk soils, whereas very few slugs are. They can exploit more acidic places like the kind of upland bogs and moorland that you get in parts of the north and west of Britain.
Because when people keep African land snails, they always suggest cuttle bone, don't they? Like a little something for them to munch on. So that's why, is it, to help the shell grow?
It can be a limiting factor in the growth of snails, but not so much in slugs. Yeah.
Because we briefly touched on this before we started recording, but snails seem to be kept as pets fairly regularly. Like you get aquatic snails, you get African land snails, but is there much in the way of slug keeping? Do people do that?
Well, I think, no, not many people do that.
Okay, I suspected so.
I think possibly that's tied into another advantage of becoming a slug, which is that you become repellent. So they don't have the protection provided by the shell, so they can invest a little more in their mucus. And the mucus is, it's almost literally the lifeblood of these animals. It flows over the body. And if you ever look at them under a magnifier, it's really amazing to watch it move. It flows over the body down those grooves and wrinkles that they have on the surface and is recycled at the back end. And they produce different kinds of mucus in different places. That mucus is a complicated mixture of chemicals in a gel. And that protects them from desiccation, it protects them from predators, whatever. And they just add a little secret ingredient to different types, like the mucus on the sole of the body, the bottom of the foot, or on the back, or whatever, if they've been attacked by a predator or something. They can just make themselves so unappealing that they don't have any predators, even when they don't have a shell. So I've handled all the slug species in Britain with my bare hands, and I can certainly tell you that some of them got particularly disgusting and tenacious mucus.
Really?
If I were a predator, I wouldn't want to have all over me, and that would certainly put me off handling them. Yeah. So that makes slugs disgusting. That's probably one reason why people don't want to keep them as pets. Others might be that people themselves have a either sort of inborn or learnt hatred of slugs.
Which we're going to get to in a second.
But you were asking about keeping them in captivity. Snails are relatively easy to keep as long as you've got enough ventilation and it's humid, but not too stuffy, and they've got some soil and they've got the right food. You could do the same with slugs, but I've kept a few. They're not hugely rewarding pets to have, really. You don't get back from them.
No, I mean, a lot of the kind of inverts are like that, I guess, aren't they? I mean, I suppose it depends what behaviours they have and whatever. But yeah, I can't imagine there's a great amount of people that keep slugs, but who knows?
No.
There might be a few out there. You mentioned predators there, which I was going to ask later, but we might as well bring it up now. Because often when you read a lot of these gardening articles and stuff, they're like, encourage natural predators for slugs. But my experience, and you'll hopefully be able to confirm this, is there are animals that will eat slugs, but there are very few animals that enjoy eating slugs. I don't know if that's a fair way to put it, but like I know frogs and stuff will eat them, but it's not their first choice.
I think you're right. They would generally form a small part of the diet of generalists. I think slow worms are fairly heavily specialised on slugs.
Yeah, I have heard that. So that's interesting to know that that slow worms, they quite like them, do they?
Yes, well, they appear to like them.
They're not rubbing their tummy after or anything, but yeah.
No. And there's something they can actually catch as well.
Yeah, that's true. The clue's in the name, isn't it? And I think that there are some beetles, aren't there? Aren't there some beetles that quite like eating slugs?
Oh, there are a lot of beetles that do that. There are many beetles that specialize in feeding on snails, and their whole body shape is adapted to get into the shell of a snail. But there are also others that specialize on running down some quite large slugs sometimes. So carabid beetles, ground beetles you see running around on a sunny spring morning. They're probably one of the most useful things you can have in your garden. Frogs do eat them, as you said. Blackbirds will eat them, and you might see them. And other thrushes, you might see them pick up a slug, and they sometimes give it a bit of a wipe on the grass to try and get the slime off. But some of this mucus is just so tenacious that that doesn't work. So I think they're probably only doing it because they're really starving. And you've talked about Springwatch and the other watches on this program a few times. I remember they had one season where they had a tawny owl that was feeding large slugs to its chick. I think it was a tawny owl. So it was going and eating them and then regurgitating these really big slugs. And an owl chick was eating slugs for at least a week, I think.
So again, would you think that's sort of a desperation thing? Like it's struggling to catch other things, and that's what, or maybe it's just an abundance of big slugs. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe, or possibly it's even an acquired taste, you know, like once you get over the initial revulsion, perhaps they're all right. I don't know.
Yeah, possibly. Because I just feel that a lot of animals, like you said, there are a lot of animals that will eat them, but there aren't many, like apart from, say, you mentioned slow worms and beetles. I think hedgehogs will occasionally eat them as well, but they don't like, because they can get parasites from them, can't they? Is that right? Is it lungworm or something that they can get from slugs?
Yes, pretty much any mammal can get lungworm from pretty much any terrestrial mollusk is the basic state of affairs. But because people hate slugs, they tend to blame slugs more than snails. But that's true in the case of hedgehogs and other wildlife as well, and dogs and cats.
Well, yeah, that I was going to say, actually, I suppose when you think about our pets, because I think cats are maybe a little bit more intelligent, but dogs just will eat anything, won't they? And particularly if they see, I've seen my dogs pick up stuff like, don't eat that, you know, you're going to get something from it. So that can be a concern. But I
think dogs are more likely to deliberately engulf them. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, so any, you know, they do transmit parasites to other animals, and of course aquatic snails do that as well. And you know, worldwide, that's a very significant problem: transmission of parasitic diseases by snails. So they do that, but hedgehogs, as you say, I mean, I've worked with people who know a lot about hedgehogs and like have been vets or whatever, and they say that it's not really their number one choice of food.
So when people talk about ways to get rid of slugs, I mean, predators, encouraging predators is going to help, but it's not going to, I was going to say problem, but there isn't necessarily a problem because we're going to talk about this, aren't we? But like, I was going to say the perceived problem of having too many slugs and snails in the garden. So which species are more likely to cause issues with gardeners? Because you mentioned there's 45 species, but it's fair to say that not all of them are going to be munching on your hostas, are they? There's going to just be a few kind of guilty parties.
Yeah, definitely. It's only a subset of them that are kind of particularly guilty of that. So, for instance, the first one that comes to mind is a slug called Dorosaurus reticulatum, which is a small kind of whitish slug which produces a milky mucus when you handle it. And they're about an inch long, maybe up to 2 inches. They can be a particular problem for grasses and cereals, which makes them economically very problematic. And the damage they cause includes eating germinating wheat grains and things like that. And because they're small, they can exist in ploughed fields, and they can live right the way through a field rather than just having to live at the edges where they've got something to hide. They just live in the top few inches of soil. And they can be really, really widespread. So that's quite often cited as the number one worst. Other ones, there's also Arion distinctus or brown soil slug. That can be almost as prolific. There's an underground species called the... I'm trying to think of these English names. I think it's called the Budapest slug, Tandonia budapestensis, which, as the name suggests, is introduced from Eastern Europe.
Oh, okay.
And that's a rather noxious pest of the underground parts of plants, including things like carrots, potatoes, or parsnips. And they get in there, they make a little hole to breach the skin, and then they go right inside. And you, if you've ever lifted potatoes or parsnips, you might have got the odd one, which looks intact, but it's got a hole in, and it's actually been completely hollowed out by slugs.
Are they a recent arrival or been here a while?
Sort of middle of the 20th century,
okay.
I think they started to become common in Britain, and they're still spreading. So if you don't have that, then you may wish to avoid bringing it into your garden.
Yeah, definitely.
So those are some of the worst. Often people wake up in the morning, they step out into the sunshine, and they see some slug damage or snail damage, and they just attribute it to the first mollusk they see. And that will usually be something like the big fat roundback slugs, like the large red slug or the large black slug, which might be happily sitting in the sun because they've got quite thick mucus and they're fairly tolerant, and they don't need to escape so quickly. Where of course the damage may have been caused by either by snails, which somehow get a pass because they're slightly prettier, or some smaller slugs that did the damage in the middle of the night and then have already retreated below ground or back to some refuge. So it can be hard to work out in a garden what's doing the damage. And if you want to be sure, the best thing to do is to go out there at nighttime with a torch and actually see what's doing what. And then if you want to control them that way, just by picking off the ones that are actually causing the damage, then you know you're targeting the right ones.
So they're framing each other, basically, aren't they?
It can look like that, yeah.
In a way, because, I think it's easy as a gardener to see these big bastard slugs and think, right, that one's been munching everything. You're the culprit. But like you say, it could very well be that they're just going about their business and it's a smaller slug that's been in, done its stuff and bugged it off.
And another thing is, I'm sure you're going to ask me sooner or later, but you can use these beer traps because slugs are attracted to beer.
Yes. Yeah. Much like myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, beer or cider or milk. You can use a variety of things, but those vary in the success of attracting different species, and the ones that they trap most effectively might not be the ones that are causing the damage as well. So
what I was going to ask, and we've kind of come on to that anyway, is the what can gardeners do if there is an issue or a perceived issue with having lots of slugs in the garden? What is the best course of action?
It's quite difficult to say. I think that, you don't get anything for nothing either. I think that the most labor-intensive methods are probably going to be the most effective. Going out at nighttime, or at least in the early morning, and then catching what you can, and then humanely dispatching them, is probably a good way to do it.
You wouldn't suggest moving them somewhere else then?
No, not really, because. No. Yeah, well, nobody's going to want them. And they do have some ability to home, partly just by returning to favored places, but they actually do. Snails, at least, definitely have a homing instinct based on
memory. They'd find their way back then if you didn't move
them
far
enough. They do, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess because I've got friends one of my friends last year collected 21 kilograms of slugs and snails out of his garden. He moved them... I don't know, maybe a mile or so away. So it could be they were coming back, but I did kind of say to him, you are just moving potentially the problem to someone else, but also you don't know what diseases or if there aren't slugs in that area already, you might be moving them around. So although it seems like a kindness, you probably shouldn't move slugs away because say if they had a non-native slug in their garden, you might then be moving that somewhere else. So I know it seems like a nice idea, but you shouldn't. The way I see it, you shouldn't be moving them.
I tend to agree, really. I mean, I'm a museum curator, so we don't really tell people what to do. But
they
can use slug pellets if they want.
Yeah.
To take 21 kilograms, is that in a single night?
No. This is over a year. This is not one night. One night would be you'd be wading through slugs, wouldn't you? If that was he got them in a bucket. He'd weigh the bucket and he'd. Right. And he'd move them along, but that was a lot.
Yeah, but you can do that. But like as you say, you risk transferring things, and if you've got lungworm larvae living in the slugs, then you could transfer those as well to another garden.
Yeah, so that That makes sense. I know one of the other kind of old wives' tales, and you might be able to tell me if this is true, is copper tape. Does that work?
I'm not an expert in slug control
No,
particularly,
okay.
but I don't think it really does work. I mean, there may be instances in which it seems to do the job, but I'm not convinced that anybody really knows why. I know that the Royal Horticultural Society have had a brilliant PhD student called Imogen Cavadino, and she's been working with Hayley Jones, I think, and others there, and she's done some experiments on these things, and she found that they weren't particularly successful, many of these
Oh, really?
improvised defenses.
Yeah, I think that makes, because there's a lot where you just think, well, like I've heard things like eggshells and wool pellets and all kinds of stuff, and you just think if that slug really wants to get past that, it's gonna find a way.
They probably would, but there could be combinations of circumstances in which those things might work well. And
Yeah.
we mustn't forget the placebo effect as well. So if something is making you feel better, then
Yeah, that's
there's
true.
no
Yeah,
reason
yeah.
not to do it.
No, I get. Yeah, it doesn't hurt, does it? I mean, give it a go. I have done beer traps in my. I did find beer traps work well, but like you say, I don't know if I'm targeting the right slugs, and it doesn't really seem to be putting a dent in it. I mean, I used beer traps for maybe a couple of months, and I was getting good amounts of slugs. And I just thought I'm not even because I suppose when you think about it logically. So I've got a relatively small garden. I live in a kind of built up estate. Not only would I have to reduce the numbers of slugs in my own garden, presumably I've got to then do all the adjacent gardens because if even by some miracle, if I got rid of them all in my garden, then they're just going to move all the slugs in the surrounding area are going to be like, oh, great, free real estate. So it you can't get. I think the idea of getting rid of slugs completely is a fantasy. You can't do that, and really, I don't think you'd want to get rid of them completely. Because as I'm sure you can tell me, slugs have got lots of benefits to gardens as well, haven't they?
Well, there's no need to eradicate them completely, and exactly as you say, it's probably impossible,
Yeah.
because each one can lay, say, roughly 100 eggs in a year. And so, if any of them survive, you're going to have the same problem next year. And some of the smaller species can have multiple generations in a year. If you
Okay.
have a wetter and warmer year than average, as we seem to keep doing, then you'll have plenty.
Yeah, it's definitely getting that way. So I am slowly trying to love the slug, if you like. So do you think it's a case that we've just got to accept them in a way?
I think I think as with any animal pest, we have to eventually reach some kind of accommodation with them. Is it with them? I'm a very amateur gardener myself, and it's interesting because everybody develops their own relationship with these mollusks, and most people don't have a relationship with any other mollusks, but with slugs you do,
Yeah.
because if they're not in your garden, then they might be coming into your kitchen and stealing the cat food. Or they might be stuck to your coat when you come home, or something like that. So, strange as it may seem, I think slugs are actually more kind of tied up with the British experience than a lot of us mollusks are.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's weird that I mean I've been living in this house now for 4 years, and the first 3 years I had slugs in my garden, but not huge amounts. And then this last year they've absolutely ballooned, and I can only think it's because it's been a relatively wet summer, the previous summer, that they've just been moving more in places they wouldn't normally get to. And I do manage my garden to be a wildlife garden, so it is perfect. I mean, they love it. There's a meadow, there's ponds, so it is a slug heaven.
Although sometimes that's kind of you to provide habitats for them, but a balanced wildlife garden might actually provide fewer opportunities for pest species than a, a pro like an intensive agriculture one would. So,
Oh, really? Well, I suppose because yeah, a lot of ornamental plants can be quite appealing, but a lot of the wild plants I suppose would have natural defenses, or slugs would naturally not necessarily want to. They definitely target certain
that's true.
ones. I mean, I've been trying to grow cornflower, and the slugs are on it straight away. They love fresh cornflower for some reason. But then there's other plants, and they just never touch them, like oxeye daisy and stuff like that. They just don't. I don't know whether they just don't like the taste or what, but some plants they don't go anywhere near.
I found that as well. I guess your best bet is to protect the cornflower seedlings until perhaps later in the summer when there aren't young slugs around and that the plants are a bit better, then I think they're more likely to survive.
I think you're right. It's either that or I need to get a bucket load of slow worms and try and go down that.
Well, that would be lovely. And of course, you know, everything's being urbanized and these populations of predators are being driven further and further out of cities. And so, you know, even I live in a fairly small town and it used to have slow worms in it, but the places where I found them have been built upon now. So I don't even know. I'm probably further away from the nearest slow worm population than I used to be.
Yeah, we don't get them in. We do get the odd one in Nottinghamshire, but not many. But my sister-in-law lives in Kent. And yeah, her garden's full of them. It's great. I love going down to visit because you're just going to compost heap and lift it up and there'll be three or four big fat slow worms sat staring at you, which is, I'd love to have that in my garden. Unfortunately, it was one of the other banes of my life is cats, and we get a lot of cats near me. And I think that would probably sort the slow worms out a little bit. I know they can be a prime target for them. So that might halt my slow worm experience.
Yeah. And it is something I've suggested before. And I know you've got strong feelings about cats and, I have to say that I think gardens with cats are more likely to have, on average, slug problems because the cats will drive away any slug predators, blackbirds, frogs, and slow worms.
Yeah, that makes. I'd never put the two together, but it won't, will it? No, that actually makes a lot of sense now that you say it. Well, I think before we go, I've got to ask you: have you got a favourite slug?
Have I got a favourite slug?
Something I should ask every guest.
No, I don't. But I like them all because the fact that they've come from all these different evolutionary routes shows that there's something about being a slug which makes it a worthy goal for a mollusk. And so you've got your carnivorous ones that feed on earthworms. You've got your semi-slugs that some of them are arboreal and they live in tropical rainforests. You've got some that can withstand the attacks of safari ants in East Africa. You've got the ones with their amazing mating behavior. You've got, all kinds of different things that different slugs do. And I think they deserve our interest and admiration, if not our actual kind of tolerance, really.
No, and obviously they're such an important key part of the environment, aren't they? Like they break down leaf litter and rotting plants and things like that. So they are a key part of the food chain, aren't they?
Yeah, and in urban environments, I think they do a useful job in cleaning up dog poo as well.
Yeah, they love it, don't they?
We'll do that. And other kind of spillages that you get on city streets.
Yes,
They do a general tidying up job. One slug that is a favourite of a lot of people is tree slug. So I'll just mention that. So it's a native British species that's completely blameless in gardens because it only feeds on lichens and algae and rusts and things like that that you grow over wet surfaces. So the two kind of environments you find it in are woodlands and also above the tree line on sort of rocky outcrops on mountaintops, right to the top of our very highest mountains. So they're very cold tolerant, very, very tough things. They're rather elegant, if drab looking slug. But they're quite impressive because the ones that live in the big forests will climb up right up into the canopy of the trees to graze on the leaves and then go right back down to the woodland floor in the daytime. So they're really quite lively and mobile compared to some of our other species.
I've not come across a tree slug. I'll have to.
Oh, I think if you go to your nearest woodland and have a look under. Did you say you're in Nottinghamshire?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Yeah, there's a place called Treswell Wood.
Oh, yes, I know it. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah, and there's a local guy there, who used to be local, Christopher, who for many years took a big role in both ornithology and limacology, so slugs, in Treswell Wood, and he loves tree slugs. He's always keen to promote them.
Oh, okay, I'll make that my mission to go find a tree slug this year. I'm always happy to tick new British wildlife off. Well, look, it's been great talking, Ben, and just to kind of get a bit more information about slugs and I feel a little bit more zen about them now, and hopefully they'll behave themselves in the garden this year.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I think as you process the experience, you'll move towards a settlement.
I think we'll get there.
That's all we can do.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get there. We'll manage. Well, look, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes, likewise. Thanks a lot. Cheers. Bye-bye.
That was Ben Rosen. It's really thought-provoking, isn't it? Because obviously I've been kind of indiscriminately getting slugs battered in my garden from slug traps and killing them. But I never really thought that some of those slug species might be completely innocent. So I'm probably going to try and go out one night in the evening, maybe put some sacrificial young plants out there and try and work out which slugs are the problem slugs and see if there's something a little bit more specific I can do rather than just indiscriminately killing every slug, because obviously some of them might not be causing an issue at all. But really great stuff. I really enjoy talking about the slugs, and I'm maybe a little bit more zen about them. Now, at the end of these podcasts, I'm recommending you a YouTube video from my channel. If you can subscribe, this is one thing that you can do to support me. You might not be able to donate to the podcast, but you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. It costs you absolutely nothing. I'm nearly at 13,000 subscribers, which I'm pretty pleased. My target is by the end of this year, I want to get to 20,000 subscribers. So if you can, please head over to my channel, Chasing Scales. There is a link in the description. Hit me a subscribe. It massively helps. If you subscribe to my channel, it means that YouTube pushes it out to more people. That gets me more views, which gets more ad revenue. So that's great. I've got lots and lots of stuff planned for YouTube while the podcast is on hiatus as well. Lots of videos coming out. So I would say if you want to kind of get your fix of content, then definitely head over there. And is that a fucking motorbike? What an absolute bell end. There's always some dickhead going by on a motorbike near me, just revving his engine. What a twat. Anyway, the video that I'm going to suggest to you is a video of me going to Iceland. I went to Iceland last year and we saw humpback whales, we saw the Northern Lights, did a little bit of fishing. It's got a bit of everything in the vid. I'll put a link in the description if you want to check that out. It's a great vid. So for the last episode, for the final episode of this series, I am talking to Jack Cooper and we're going to be talking about a subject that I've wanted to talk about for ages, and that is Megalodon. So we're going to be talking all things Megalodon in the last episode of the season. As always, this has been the Bearded Tits Podcast. I've been your host, Jack Perks, and I'll see you next Tuesday. Cheers.